what occurred may well have been the fact that they were thrust through time and space. In other words, they were taken out. They were deliberately removed from space-time to experience whatever they did and placed back in an instant of time. But obviously, that instant in our time could be an eternity in a parallel dimension.
Andrew Collins. The book is Origins of the Gods, co-written with Gregory Little, Kesem Cave, Skinwalkers, and Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. My guest is Andrew Collins. He's a science and history writer investigating the origins of human civilization since 1995. You may be familiar with him. He's appeared on Ancient Aliens. He actually has another upcoming appearance on The Unexplained with William Shatner, and says he has yet to meet William Shatner. So there you go. High praise from Eric von Daniken. Now, he's the one who wrote The Chariots of the Gods. 1968. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago. But in the book, and I'll condense his foreword, he said, this book, we're talking about Origins of the Gods, Kesem Cave, Skinwalkers, and Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. He says, this book is a milestone. Here it is proven, as clean as a whistle, that many a finding that was considered certain has to be revised. Origins of the Gods should become a textbook and compulsory reading in all schools. Eric von Daniken. And here's Andrew Collins.
Greg and I, that's Greg Little, who is the co-author of the new book, Origins of the Gods, and I've been working together since the early 2000s when I first went over to the States to do a Edgar Cayce Foundation conference. And, you know, he chauffeured me around with his good wife, Laura, and we just realized that our attitude and our approach to the UFO phenomena and the paranormal in general was absolutely identically matched. You know, we shared an interest in John Keel's work, you know, Mothman, the idea that, you know, UFOs and aliens were something that has been greatly misrepresented, you know, by the media, in books, in television, in films. In the sense that it's always been focused towards the idea that any UFO that's seen is a nuts and bolts spacecraft, you know, right the way down to the idea that when we speak about UFOs, we talk about them flying or hovering or landing, you know, which are all mechanistic terms. And of course, all of this comes from the idea that back in 1947, when the modern era of flying saucers began, that we were dealing with vehicles coming in from other planets. Initially, this was, you know, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, places like this, places that we hadn't explored at that time. And then very gradually, as we ourselves understood the universe better, the places where these UFOs were coming from were getting further and further away. You know, whether it was Zeta Reticuli or Draco, you know, or Orion or the Pleiades or somewhere like this. And all of these interpretations were being placed upon the phenomena that was being seen in the sky. Now, as early as 1963, Carl Sagan, the great cosmologist and astronomer who worked with NASA for many years, wrote a paper in which he said that the Earth would have been visited by extraterrestrials on countless occasions, you know, since the beginning of humanity. And even suggested that we start looking in things like the Sumerian ancient texts for evidence of this. And if he said this as far back as 1963, I think we should seriously consider that at least some of the UFOs that are seen are extraterrestrial vehicles. But to be honest, that does not account for the majority of them. Most of them are lights, you know, like objects of light, whether they be circular, whether they be oval, whether they be discoid, whether they be clusters of light, whether they be large, small, nebulous, or even solid. And this suggests that something else was actually going on. And over the years, I gradually put together the idea that we were perhaps looking at something that was utilizing plasma, the fourth state of matter, to manifest into our three-dimensional region of space and obviously one dimension of time, and that what we are actually seeing is the manifestation of intelligences and beings that were coming in from a higher dimensional reality. The way that I concluded this was I investigated the first ever UFO abduction case that was ever reported in this country, in the UK. It happened in 1974. It was reported in 1977. And it was a whole family of five driving along in a car on a very short journey. And it was evening. It was quiet country road. And they saw this oval blue light above them. And it came into view, disappeared from view, and they thought that that was it. But then as they rounded a corner, the car headlights failed, the engine failed. They could no longer hear the sound of the tyres over the road. And right in front of them was a luminous bank of green mist. So this is like a fog that had a green intense light within it. And they entered inside this, and they remember feeling nauseous. They remember everything just stopping. And then the next thing they know, they're 3/4 of a mile further on, and they get home from this short journey, and they realize that 3 hours are missing from their life. Now, hypnosis was used, and it was considered that they'd had an onboard experience, that the hypnosis revealed, that they'd gone aboard a spacecraft and et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, this was firmly believed, but there were certain elements of this which even the family themselves said there's something wrong, something not quite right with the way that the hypnosis has said this is what happened. Because as they went into the mist, 2 out of 3 of the children were in the back of the car asleep. The third one was standing up with his hands on the passenger and the driver's seat, sort of holding on. And he was very excited than having seen this, this UFO in the sky. And when they came out, seemingly 3 hours later and 3/4 of a mile further on from where they encountered this mist, everybody was in exactly the same place. The child was still standing up with his hands on the seat. The other two were still asleep. And, of course, they had no memory of what had happened. But I started to think about it. I thought, how is that possible? If they were aboard a spacecraft for 3 hours, how is it that they came out exactly the same, in the same positions as when they went in? Did it mean that the aliens were, wanted to make sure that they didn't realise anything could happen by making the two small children go back to sleep and getting the other one to stand in exactly the same position? And I began to realise this just didn't make sense at all. And what I thought at that point was that maybe, just maybe, they had actually shifted through time and space. In other words, when they'd entered inside that luminous green mist, they hadn't gone 3 hours in normal Earth time, if you like, but that the shift had taken place immediately, and that whatever experience that their minds told them had happened was to fill in the gaps of what had seemingly occurred during those 3 hours. Now, this is not to say that their minds made it up, not whatsoever, because the family firmly believed that they had been abducted by an intelligence. And John Day, the man of the family, felt that he could communicate with this intelligence thereafter, and probably still does to this day. I mean, he's still alive. I still know him. And, he's happy to accept that what occurred may well have been the fact that they were thrust through time and space. In other words, they were taken out. They were deliberately removed from space-time to experience whatever they did and placed back in an instant of time. But obviously, that instant in our time could be an eternity in a parallel dimension, or what I like to call a bubble universe, because I think that's what they went into. They went into an environment created by that luminous green mist that was a temporarily physical bubble universe that they were able to enter, and that there was an intelligence involved with it, and that intelligence created the environment of the inside of this spacecraft, if you like, to communicate with them, almost like a dreamscape that allowed them to have these experiences, and that the intelligence that they continued afterwards to be in touch with was the same intelligence. And I don't necessarily think that it was extraterrestrial in nature. I think that it was transdimensional in nature.
Have you had some anomalous experiences that go along with this?
Have I had any encounters myself? Not close, in all honesty. I mean, the closest I came to it, and the psychology behind this is very interesting as well. It goes all the way back to the 1970s. And I went to a place called Warminster, which at the time was having what they called it then, in them days, a UFO flap. In other words, there was lots and lots of UFOs being seen on a regular basis. And I arrived there really late with a whole carload of friends, including one, Barry King, who was a well-known UFO investigator as well, the same as I was. And we were just looking for somewhere to park up for the night. And then we weren't even at the most well-known spot. And we went down this trackway, and it was now about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was a dense fog, so you couldn't see any more than probably about 100 to 150 yards away. And suddenly we saw this incredibly bright light coming towards us. And it seemed to be at the level of a motorcycle headlight. And it seemed to be bouncing up and down slightly, almost as if it was like following the contours of the ploughed field that it was coming across. And this further convinced us that this was a mechanical vehicle, coming to perhaps throw us off their land, it was the farmer. But so we continued the journey, but the light didn't follow us. It sort of followed a path that, as we went up this hill, it sort of like then came behind us and went up into the tree. I mean, we didn't know what we were seeing at the time. All we knew is that, it probably wasn't the farmer. And we came to a halt, and we got out the car and just looked back down. It had now gone out of sight. And we thought, well, what was that? We had no idea. So we just got in the car and just fell asleep. I mean, we didn't investigate, didn't do anything, which is really peculiar because, we were investigators. Well, the next morning we woke up, and of course, suddenly into our heads was, well, what the hell happened last night? So we went back along that same track and realized that there was hedgerow and walls all the way along it, and that nothing could have come out of the field, onto the road, the little track, and then across onto the other side, unless it was going through the air. And we then investigated, and we found that in that general area, this ball of light had kept being seen, and that local investigators a few years earlier had tried to chase it, and it had shot straight over their head. And this was within just a few hundred yards of where they'd seen, their light. Plus, we found out only years later, somebody came up to me and they said, we read your account of what happened in one or other of your books. They said, do you realise that within a week, about a week later, somebody else was in almost an identical spot. They also saw a light, but then saw an entity approach them as well. And the whole thing, they basically blacked out, and there was a very strange weirdness occurred. And, so it was like a real close encounter. And it was exactly the same spot. And clearly they didn't know about our experience, and I certainly didn't know about theirs until many, many years later. So, this confirms to me that we've seen something peculiar.
You've obviously since then had a few other encounters in areas that have a similar anomaly.
Martha in Texas is somewhere that produces light phenomena on a very regular basis. But, most people get the idea that you're just talking about a few bobbing lights off in the distance. But what I showed in my book, Light Quest, which came out in the year 2012, is that there are several really important close encounters that have taken place in Martha, where objects were seen at very close quarters, and that some of these cases involved objects that are very clearly sentient in nature. In other words, you were dealing with objects that were mostly of light that were present and giving the impression that they were intelligent in their own right. In other words, that the object itself was sentient, was alive, quite literally. And this puts a different spin on it, because, so many writers talk about Martha And I say, oh, it's just, you know, the distant headlights of, you know, cars on a highway, or it's the lights of you know, railway locomotives going along, or something like this in the distance. I mean, it's just, that's just rubbish, to be honest. I mean, you know, of course, people always mistake mundane phenomena for, you know, weird light phenomena. But as far as Mars is concerned, there's something special about it. And I think what we have to start asking ourselves is, what is the commonality between all of these places, between places like Martha or Warminster in Wiltshire in southern England, which where I saw this light, you know, or even other sites that are in the news today, like Skinwalker Ranch. The fact is that today they would all be referred to as portal locations. And what does that mean? Well, it basically means that the environment is perfect for the manifestation of both paranormal and UFO phenomena. Why is it perfect? Because of the intense geology that exists at those locations. This was something that was first put forward in 1977 by a Canadian biochemist or scientist by the name of Michael Persinger, and Ghislaine Lafreniere, his colleague, in a book called Space-Time Transient: An Unusual Phenomena, which is an incredibly extraordinary book. And to be honest, it didn't really become popular, I mean, for many years, but its ideas were looked upon by people like Paul Devereux, who was an earth mystery researcher and the editor of something called The Ley Hunter, which was in the late 70s. When he was doing a whole lot of work at stone circles around the country in Britain to find out whether there was any kind of anomalous phenomena associated with them, because many of them had themselves been associated with mysterious lights and other types of strange phenomena. And he created something called the Dragon Project. And this was the monitoring of prehistoric sites like stone circles over a prolonged period of time. And, you know, he also realized that there was a geological component here, not only to the sighting of these UFOs and the paranormal phenomena, but also of stone circles as well, and other types of prehistoric monument like dolmens and long barrows and things like this, that very often they were located very close to certain types of geology, in particular fault lines or the coming together of tectonic plates, or particular types of minerals such as quartz and tourmaline and metal ores. And all of these are able to produce electricity in the earth. And what that essentially means is that certain types of particles known as electrons can be released from their atoms due to high pressure in the earth, and that these would be released into the atmosphere, and we're talking not just a few here, we're talking about, you know, countless ones, creating a whole environment. And these environments, which are known as electron bursts, you know, in scientific circles, then become the right environment for something known as ionization to take place. And this is essentially the splitting up of particles into different types of ions, positive ions, which is the atom being freed up of electrons, and the actual electrons themselves, which are known as negative ions. What happens is that these freed up electrons become very excited, and as they become excited, they release photons of light. Now, they're tiny, tiny little packets or particles of light. You know, of course, the whole thing becomes illuminated like a light bulb suddenly being switched on, and these are contained within self-generated electromagnetic fields. And suddenly you have in front of you a ball of light, or an oval of light, or a pear shape of light, or, you know, whatever else that you want. And what's being created here is known as plasma. And plasma is the full state of matter. We know about solid. We know about, you know, liquids. We know about gases. Well, there's a type of matter beyond that, and that's plasma. Plasma makes up anything up to 99% of the universe, some scientists have speculated. And it is the light that comes from the sun. You know, it's the light that would come from black holes or neutron stars that generate plasma. It's what we see when we see lightning, when we see lightning flashes, that's plasma. Ball lightning is plasma, as is, you know, the light that comes from our smart TVs. I mean, many of those use plasma to actually generate light so that we can see, you know, the pixels and whatever. So plasma is a very, very important type of matter in its own right. And it comes in different forms. It can be quite solid. It can be quite nebulous. You know, it can be very large. It can be small. It can come in different colours. It can be like fogs, like electronic fogs, just like what the Day family encountered in the UK in 1974. In fact, I am dead certain what they encountered was an electronic fog, basically. And there are countless cases of people encountering this type of fog or mist. Jenny Randles, the very well-known British UFO researcher and writer, she wrote a whole book about them, partly based on the Day experience, you know, from this place called Averley in southern England, which I've been talking about, called Time Storms. And if if any of your listeners want a good book, definitely get that, because that is full of accounts of people that come in contact with these electronic fogs and quite literally experience, you know, not just electromagnetic anomalies, gravitational anomalies, but also distortions in time space itself. So why, you might say, would you get distortions in time and space? Well, a number of theoretical physicists have recently come forward, and there's a number of references to this in, you know, Greg and my new book, Origins of the Gods, that suggest that plasma, once it is there, actually has an extra dimension of space. So in other words, instead of just having three dimensions of space and one of time, which is what we have in our own physical reality, once plasma opens up, it's an environment with an extra dimension of space. And if that's so, then it could become the interface between this physical reality and whatever lies on the outside of normal space-time. And that's crucial, because UFOs themselves could actually be portals. In other words, they themselves are doorways or gateways into some kind of higher realm. And I think that's exactly what happened to this family back in 1974. And that's what allowed them to enter into this bubble universe and for them to be taken out of space-time and then thrust back into it, having lost 3 hours and three quarters of a mile in distance in our own particular physical reality. And as I said, a lot of these ideas were in my book, Light Quest, which came out in 2012. But today, in 2022, plasma is one of the biggest buzzwords in the UFO community right now. You know, the other buzzwords would be the word portal, and also the idea of transdimensional. You know, the idea that we are not simply dealing with extraterrestrial beings, but we could be dealing with transdimensional intelligences, and that we are only now beginning to get to grips with that possibility, so that when we see UFOs, we could be looking at not just intelligences in their own right, but portals or doorways into a higher dimensional state.
Andrew Collins, Origins of the Gods, Kesem Cave, Skinwalkers in Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. And you can see him at the Awakening Conference. This is Awakening June 24th to 26th, Transdimensional Plasma Intelligences. He's going to talk about that. Quick break.
It's quite clear that this is a portal location. This is an idealistic showcase portal location.
Covering the gamut from shamanism to the paranormal and ancient history, this is one of the best books that I've read, Origins of the Gods, Kesem Cave, Skinwalkers in Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. Again, co-author Gregory Little with the first half and Andrew Collins, the second half. You even went to Skinwalker Ranch. I saw the video.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was lucky enough during the writing of the book Origins of the Gods to be invited out to Skinwalker Ranch and was able to spend a couple of days, not just with, you know, familiar faces from the TV show, but also to talk to the people that just happened to be working on the ranch. I mean, obviously, there's a number of people who are there for other reasons. And I spoke to, you know, just the workers, and all of them had stories to tell of objects being seen either high in the sky or very low going over the northern mesa there. And, of course, I learned all of the stories from the guys from the TV show, all their personal experiences, some of which you know about, others which just didn't make the TV show. And that it's quite clear that this is a portal location. This is a idealistic showcase portal location. You know, the type of paranormal phenomena that's going on there, which is everything from poltergeist phenomena, both indoors and outdoors, to strange electromagnetic anomalies, the appearances of strange beings, of cryptids, you know, like oversized wolves or so-called lycans, which is the correct term for a dog man or a dog-headed biped, to the obvious viewing of UFOs, big and small, you know, some at close quarters, some far away, and everything in between, quite literally. And it's obviously not just Skinwalker Ranch. I mean, there's another ranch next to it, which has not made the news. And I mean, I know all about it. And I was going to name it in the book, but I got cold feet eventually because, you know, I got permission to do so. But they're having almost exactly the same phenomena going on there. In fact, some of theirs is just so weird, you wouldn't believe it. And so it's not simply Skinwalker Ranch itself. It's that part of the Utah basin in Utah itself, which is causing this phenomena. And why? Because if you start looking at the geology of the location, you will find that along the northern mesa, which is where most of the phenomena takes place on Skinwalker Ranch itself, there is a fault line, you know, and that's been recorded by the US Geological Survey, and you can see it on maps. And, you know, obviously it's been recorded for a certain distance, but the chances are that it continues right along the length of that mesa. And what's so interesting about that is that the first peoples of the area, the Utes and the Navajo, believe that that mesa is haunted by what they call a skinwalker, hence obviously the name of the ranch today. So what is a skinwalker? Well, a skinwalker is the supernatural form that a Navajo witch, and that's the term, although that's an English language translation of the actual term, takes when they do their ceremonies, get into an altered state, and transform into an animal. And normally that animal is a wolf. What's so interesting is that the word for wolf in Navajo is the same as witch, that they are interchangeable. I mean, I can't remember exactly what it is at the moment, it's in the book. And it's exactly the same word. So, you know, wolves are the most expected supernatural form that a Navajo shaman or witch will actually take during these, you know, these ceremonies where they will go out of the body. And of course, what happened at Skinwalker Ranch is that the Utes, who were the enemies and remain to this day the enemies of the Navajo, would see these creatures and experience other type of paranormal phenomena on that northern mesa, which up to that time, by the way, had been sacred land, almost like a no man's land, which could be used, you know, for rituals. I mean, there are various sites up on that mesa, including rock art and what appears to be almost like a sort of stone circle, which would clearly have been used for ritual purposes. And obviously, after the troubles between the two tribes, when the Utes started seeing what they interpreted as skinwalkers, they believed that they'd been put under a curse, rightly or wrongly, who knows. So that's why the skinwalker became associated with that location. But the northern mesa is known to the Utes as the path of the skinwalker, and that path corresponds precisely with the directional flow and position of that fault line. And the actual rock itself is a type of sandstone that's full of quartz, and that quartz becomes powderized, you know, with the wind, the desert effects, all the rest of it. And it becomes like a powder that covers the area there. And if you move around, you have to wear scarves there, because otherwise, you know, these tiny, tiny flecks of quartz will get inside you, and, you know, they can cause problems. So everybody, as they're moving around, will generally wear scarves there for that reason. And that quartz is very, very important. Quartz, and the reason why quartz and tourmaline, by the way, I mean, a lot of people talk about quartz, but tourmaline is just as important, is that it has a property known as piezoelectricity. And what this means, that if it is put under pressure, you know, by the stresses and strains of the earth, or artificially, I mean, you know, it's a party trick if you want to try and do it, is that it will create these electron flows. And when these electrons are freed up, they burst, they create these bursts of light. So that if you've got two good pieces of quartz, for instance, you put them in a bucket, it works better in water. If you put them in a bucket, turn all the lights out and scrape them together really fast, you'll see all these bright lights appearing within the quartz. Well, that, in many ways, is what's known as ionization, which is the process that leads to the creation of plasma. And, I mean, as simple as that might seem, this, in many ways, is the stuff that creates a lot of UFOs. Not all, let's stress this. As we said, Carl Sagan himself, you know, quite clearly stated that we would have been visited by extraterrestrials on many occasions, and are certainly, therefore, still are being visited. So some, at least, of what we see is possibly extraterrestrial vehicles. But, of course, interpreting what we see is the biggest game. You know, and I mean, most people will look on YouTube or on social media and see these videos of UFOs that put out, and I can tell you now that probably 3/4 of them at least are fake, you know. And to be honest, the ones that look the better are the more chance they're going to be made in a studio somewhere, and they're just put out to see how many people they can fool. Just a fact. It's, you know, it's just what people do. But of course, some of those videos are really, really interesting and quite clearly show incredibly strange phenomena, but it's seeing what we say, that the wood for the trees, you know. In other words, you know, can you spot a genuine UFO video from all of the fakes that are out there?
Part of it is that there's so much interest that some people don't care if it's fake or not. It's just something that they are curious about, and it validates their curiosity, you know. With this, though, when you're talking about this, again, the book Origins of the Gods with Andrew, there's an intro from Eric von Däniken. And that's somebody, you know, people remember, because that was basically kind of the start with Chariots of the Gods, talking about ETs being potentially real and having seeded the planet. Can you go there?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, that book was very, very important. We're talking about Chariots of the Gods here by Eric von Däniken. It came out originally in Germany in 1968. It was a big hit around the world in the 1970s. And it asked questions which, to be honest, had already been asked in various other books going all the way back to the 50s. But the way that he put it, he just made it very straightforward. You know, he looked at some things like the Great Pyramid in Egypt, the Nazca Lines in Peru, Stonehenge in the UK, you know, in similar places around the world, and said, is it possible that the technology involved with the construction of this site could have been helped by extraterrestrials? That was the question he said again and again in the book. And it made people think. You know, and quite clearly we've got the TV show Ancient Aliens Today, which I, you know, take part in. Mm-hmm. And it's asking the same questions, you know, looking at our technology, looking at human evolution, looking at innovation, and saying, is it possible that we could have had help somewhere along the way? Well, of course, one solution is that it was direct from extraterrestrials coming down here in physical form. And there are many, many accounts around the world from folklore and legends, mythology, of vehicles coming down with beings on them, interacting with mortal humans, sometimes, having them as partners and create and them having offspring, and those offspring become the foundations of dynasties and things like this, and then these beings go back to the sky. I mean, this is what the mythology says. I mean, whether it be Native American, whether it be in the South Seas, whether it be in places like China or Japan or whatever, places like these, they're there. I mean, nobody can deny that these myths and legends are there. And that tells us there is a possibility that we could be dealing with physical nuts and bolts, spacecraft, flesh and blood, aliens. That's fine. But I think that something else has been going on as well, something that's probably been affecting humanity since the beginning. And that is that if these transdimensional beings exist, and we'll look at where they come from in a minute, if they exist, then have they been able to influence us through the appearance of these mysterious lights, which we can see in terms of sentient beings in their own right? In other words, that the plasma constructs or the plasma objects are able to be inhabited quite literally by these transdimensional intelligences. And once that happens, they are able to interact with humanity. Now, how would they do that? Well, obviously, it could be through the sort of experiences that we know today as abductions or, you know, missing time or, you know, close encounters or whatever. But in addition to this, plasma environments, as I said, are made of electrons. Electrons is essentially what allows our brain to function or our nervous system to work. You know, it's electrons. And because of that, the idea that there may be some kind of entangled link between us and the phenomena becomes a possibility. And what I mean by entangled, I mean quantum entanglement. Quantum entanglement is something which has been known since, I think the 1926, Einstein and his colleagues first wrote about it. And this is the idea that two particles can be twins. And once they become twins, no matter how far away they get from each other, they will retain an instantaneous relationship between the two of them. So that if you tweak one, the other one, no matter how far away it gets, will respond in an equal and opposite way at exactly the same time. And if that's just one particle, there are whole systems of entangled particles working, and they now become the mechanism that could explain everything from telepathy to mind over matter to black holes to white holes to wormholes and many other things. And although a lot of scientists have said up until very recently that quantum entanglement only works on what they call the microcosmic scale, it's now been proved within the last 5 years that entanglement works on a macrocosmic level as well. In other words, in the real world in which we live, you know, with physical matter. And therefore, the idea that entanglement could involve the human mind and interactions with not just other human beings, but phenomena like plasma objects and the intelligences associated with them becomes very real. And I think that's exactly what's happening. And I think that it's been happening all the way along, because if these UFOs and mystery lights are associated with the environments created by geology, then this is not something that started in 1947 with the Roswell incident or, the classic sightings from that period. This is clearly something that's been going on, not just for hundreds or thousands of years, but for millions of years. You know, this same phenomena will have been seen by the very earliest, you know, precursors of human beings as much as 2 million years ago. And this is very intriguing, because the place that we begin is on Africa's Rift, Great Rift Valley, in places like what is today Kenya and Ethiopia. And something happens in these areas on the Great Rift Valley at that time. And firstly, we invent fire for the first time. And secondly, we create beautiful, multifaceted gem or crystal-like hand axes for the first time in a style which then continues to be used for, right the way down to about 200,000 years when the style of tool manufacture changes once again. So what happened? What happened to us in the African Rift Valley at that time? Well, the relationship between the creation of fire and the creation of these stone tools is that once we create fire, we start using it inside caves. And once we start using it in the caves, we put all sorts of plants on that fire to burn. And at some point, our ancestors would have put psychoactive plants on it. By accident, they'd have just found them, just chucked them on. And it would have started to shift their state of mind. And very gradually, they would have realized that which type of plants were doing this. And they would have singled them out and been able to use them to induce similar states. And at such time, you start to think differently. You start to think, about the deeper meaning of life and, the stuff that you do when you're in deep thought. And this would have started to change things. You'd have started to invent everything from creativity to art to symbolic language and communication in a way that should not have been there before. And I think that it's also under such circumstances that through the mind and through entanglement that we start being able to communicate with the intelligences associated with this phenomena, with these plasma objects, with UFOs, at the right type of environment where you've got all these geological factors. And the Great Rift Valley is probably one of the most geologically powerful, intensive places on the whole of the planet, basically. Certainly, somewhere that you can inhabit, at least. Obviously, there's many out at sea, of course, tectonic plates and stuff like this all coming together. But, there's no question that the intense geology, whether it be geomagnetic, whether it be gravitational anomalies, they're all found on that Great Rift Valley where our earliest ancestors evolved for the first time. So you might say, is there any further evidence than this? Well, the book Origins of the Gods spends a lot of time in Israel. Why does it spend its time in Israel? Well, there has been incredible discoveries just outside of Tel Aviv. There is a cave there known as the Kesem Cave. And it was discovered in the year 2000 when they were building a new highway. And people were occupying there from 400,000 years ago down to 200,000 years ago. And the archaeologists who have been working on there for the last 20-odd years discovered, amongst many other things, the earliest evidence of shamanism anywhere in the world. And this is a bone, a wing bone, which is very, very important because that's what gives a bird flight, of a swan that had been clearly removed from the animal. And obviously the feathers were removed and it had been modified. In other words, preserved specifically for use in what we might call cultic practices or shamanism. In other words, as paraphernalia by the shaman to get into an altered state, to allow them to get into otherworldly realms and communicate with otherworldly intelligences. Well, very close to the Kesem Cave is a mountain called Mount Gerizim. Mount Gerizim is really important, not just because of the Kesem people, because they went there to get their rock, the flint that they used to create their tools, showing that they definitely had an interest in this place. But secondly, is in Bible times, in the book of Genesis and beyond that, in other books of the Old Testament, it is very clearly the dwelling place of God, the original so-called Bethel, you know, the dwelling or house of God. God himself, the God of the Israelites, was said to live here. And, for instance, Abraham, when he entered the promised land for the first time, found himself in communication with God, who manifested in front of him and, you know, basically said, look, this is the promised land, you know, your descendants will inherit it, et cetera, et cetera, and they'll be the Israelites, et cetera. His grandson, Jacob, experiences angels going up and down between heaven on a ladder, exactly the same location. Joshua leading the Israelites out of the wilderness of Sinai after 40 years with the Ark of the Covenant, goes to Mount Gerizim and does a huge, great ceremony. It's the very first place they get to and go to once they enter the Promised Land. And so, you know, it's very clear that this site is very important. And unfortunately, its importance was suppressed in later times by those Israelites that moved off to Jerusalem and made Jerusalem the center of the Jewish faith. They tried to suppress the significance of Mount Gerizim, but it's still there to see in the book of Genesis, for instance. And I spend a whole chapter in my part of the book, you know, showing why Mount Gerizim was so important in the past. But here's the important thing, is that God appeared on Mount Gerizim in his form as the Shekinah. The Shekinah means the presence of God, and that relates to light, the appearance of God as manifestations of light in exactly the same way that he appeared on the top of Mount Sinai, you know, when Moses went up there to get the ten, you know, the laws, and also to get the instructions on how to build the Ark of the Covenant. And what was the Ark of the Covenant? It was a temporary vehicle in which they could carry God around so that God could manifest above it, above the so-called mercy seat, in his form as the Shekinah. So in other words, they would see him as this blinding light above it. And what do we know about the Ark? You get too close to the Ark, you know, you can get burns, radiation burns. Well, that's exactly what happens with electromagnetic radiation, which is what is produced by plasma. And, of course, that's also what happens to many people when they come too close to UFOs, is that they will experience electromagnetic or electrostatic effects. And sometimes these can be, you know, quite disruptive to bodily systems. You know, people get severe burns, yeah. Radiation sickness and stuff like this. And these are byproducts of plasma. It doesn't always happen, by the way. I mean, there are different types of plasma. Some plasmas you can go right up to and touch, basically, and they don't have the same impact. However, quite clearly, plasma was seen as the manifestation of God to the Israelites. And that's what was seen on Mount Gerizim. And if that allowed the Israelites to believe that their God lived on that mountain, then the chances are that the Kezem people from 400 to 200,000 years ago also came in contact with the same light phenomena. The geology, for instance, of Mount Gerizim is extraordinary, with fault lines crossing all the way through it, tectonic plates crossing through the nearby Jordan Valley, coming up from Africa. It's absolutely ideal for the manifestation of mysterious light. You know, in other words, it's a portal location, just like Skinwalker Ranch or any of the other similar sites that produce UFO phenomena on a regular basis.
The one thing you have in LightQuest that I think is helpful for people who want an up-close and personal experience, you have maps and designate areas that are hotspots for certain types of phenomena.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I did LightQuest, it was, as the title said, you know, your own quest for these objects of light, basically, and the intelligences associated them. So the book gave not just examples of portal locations, mostly in the UK and mostly in the States, to be honest, because obviously otherwise it would be just too big a book. But, you know, what it did was it said, look, this location lots and lots of phenomena, but much of it close encounters. This is the important thing, not just bobbing lights, but close encounters. And look at the geology. The geology at every one of these sites is more or less the same. You have fault lines, tectonic plates. You have specific types of minerals. You have specific types of metal ores. Because obviously one of the important things about metal is that it's perfect conductors of electricity. I mean, it's perfect for it. And that's one of the reasons why it's such an important mineral. Ores are so important because they will carry electrons, basically. But I think that what's important, as far as, you know, any of the listeners here is concerned, they'll be saying, look, this is all very nice and, you know, maybe you're right, but, you know, I firmly believe that UFOs are alien spacecraft coming down here from other planets. Now, and, you know, what you're describing is not the type of UFOs that I have in mind. Well, I don't totally understandable, and I'm not going to take away people's, you know, own personal views. In fact, I support them. I mean, you know, if you believe that every UFO is a vehicle from another planet, great, fine. But I believe, and many of my colleagues are now beginning to come to the conclusion that we are dealing with something else. Something else is going on here in the background, and that may even be the primary phenomena, and that it has genuine intelligences associated with it, incredibly powerful, very advanced intelligences, and that they are multidimensional in nature. And we call them N-dimensional beings, or N beings for short. What does that mean? Well, the N stands for number. And this is the term that's used within quantum science, when you don't know how many dimensions are involved with a particular equation. So you just got N. Because these could be five-dimensional, they could be 11-dimensional, and that's a very strong possibility. But equally, you know, there are other theories to do with, you know, multidimensionality that suggests that we could be dealing with 32 dimensions. So we don't know exactly. So we just call them N beings for short. And these N beings, we think, have been around, you know, since the beginning of humanity. They have been, you know, essentially watching the timeline, if you like, of human development. Because if they are multidimensional, they are outside of normal space-time. That means they're outside of time. In other words, they're not in the here and now. When you encounter them, for you it's the here and now, but for them, they're at the, you know, they've been around since the day you were born and will be around since the day you die. You know, they will always be there. And how many UFO encounters are there where people feel a connection with the phenomena that they see? The phenomena doesn't just respond to them, probably through entanglement, but the people feel a personal connection, one that they retain afterwards for the rest of their life. They even might feel that they retain a link with the intelligence involved. And when they actually see the phenomena, they feel as if it's like a friend returning, even though they're watching it for the first time. Why should people feel that? And that's because the intelligence that they're dealing with isn't in the here and now. It's, you know, in many ways, the contact that's being made with them is almost like something that's chosen for that moment, for that contact to take place. That intelligence, by virtue of the fact that they're outside of normal space-time, had been watching that person for their entire life, from the day they were born to the day they die. That's why people feel so personally connected when they see this phenomenon. I mean, you know, I know people that have had one major trigger experience, and they spend years, if not decades afterwards, trying to recreate that, to try and reconnect with exactly what happened. Not just simply because it was a pretty sight that they saw, but because they feel that personal connection with it, and they want it again. They want to experience that once more. You know, and this is something which I think would not come simply from an extraterrestrial intelligence. You're dealing with something here that's much stronger in its influence upon humanity. And I think that intelligence is multidimensional. And as I said, we call them N beings.
It changes you.
Yeah.
It's bigger.
And why should it change then? I mean, okay, if say, for instance, you go to a foreign country, you're in a jungle, and you see an animal that you've never seen before, you know, you might think, oh, that's incredible, you know, that I experienced that animal, and, you know, maybe you'll read books afterwards, but you won't feel that same type of connection as you do if you see a genuine UFO. It's a different type of thing altogether.
Now, Andrew's going to be appearing at the Awakening event. He also has a special announcement planned. He couldn't give me any details about that, so you'll have to check that out during the event. Again, that's June 24th through 26th, the Awakening event. Follow Andrew on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. AndrewCollins.com is the website. He also has an author's page on Amazon. Links are posted in the description for the show.
UFOs themselves could actually be portals. In other words, they themselves are doorways or gateways into some kind of higher realm.
Thanks for listening. Stay curious.